on DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is 5 Live.
Julian is here because he has what sounds like a fantastic film, brand new and based on one of your old childhood favourite books.
It is indeed. It's called, the film is called From Time to Time, but it's actually based on a on one of a series of novels by Lucy M. Boston called the Green No books. And in a way, the better known one is The Children of Green No, but this is second.
K-N-O-W-E. Yes.
And this is the second book, which is The Chimneys of Green No. And it was always, you know, a big favourite of mine. And one of the nicest things is when you go back and take these things that have kind of haunted your life as opposed to just come in lately. And, you know, by some miracle of luck, we were able to attract this fantastic cast. Really wonderful
excuse
cast, though.
Excuse me. By some accident of luck.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in luck.
Oscar-winning Julian Fellowes is writing, producing and directing. I think that's kind of part of the deal.
Well, you know, it just is so wonderful. You send out this, you know, you get your first list and you send out the invitations and you hope to get one or two of them and you've got all of them. I mean, that's luck. And, you know, with Maggie Smith and Timothy Spall and Dominic West and Hugh Bonneville and Pauline Collins and Carice Van Houten, who was so wonderful in Black Book.
Yeah.
Do you remember last
year?
Yeah,
of course.
Absolutely marvellous actress, actually. So that was all very, very thrilling. And now we have the film.
So the story sounds intriguing because we're over a couple of time zones here, really.
It's in two periods. It takes place between the end of the war and the Regency. And this boy, Tolly, has to come and stay with his grandmother. And they don't really know each other because she loathes his mother, her daughter-in-law. She can't stand her. And so the child's really grown up without any real contact with his grandmother. And now they're both sort of hostile at the beginning. And they, of course, discover they have a great deal more in common than they realized. And so that is the kind of overall journey between those two. But within that, he gets drawn into the story of the house and he, you know, a bit of time travel and he goes back and ghost story. I mean, it's a kind of family ghost story, but it also has elements for adults. You know, it's about prejudice in a way. I mean, you know, in the war story, it's the prejudice against the boy and his mother and all of that stuff. And then in the Regency, there's a sort of a racial prejudice story and various other things. And then, you know, it all gets resolved. But it also makes you cry. And,
very good.
You know, that's the good thing about having good actors.
The good doctor cries at everything.
That's
he
just
cries
not
in
true.
Every it, single.
That's just I cry in the advertisement when the child drops her paper flower in the puddle. Do you remember? And then she has to have her top washed or something. Every time I saw this, tears would be streaming down my face.
I think that is stretching the point, actually.
This is a family film?
This is a family film, but, I mean, someone has just compared it very flatteringly to The Railway Children, but in the same way, it's a family film, but it really has got stuff for all the family. It's not just a children's film.
It also sounds slightly similar to that, the film, of course, which was called The Amazing Mr. Blondin, which is based on that Antonio Fed, that book, The Ghosts, which is a sort of similar idea. Which
well,
again,
they were
was,
both directed by Lana
yes,
Jeffries.
Absolutely. And I think Amazing Mr. Blondin actually is the better of the two films, and I think it has more of appeal across, you know, from both young and old.
They're both marvellous. Marvellous. I always wonder why he didn't do any more, because he didn't. He did those two. And then that was it.
No. But I mean, Amazing Mr. Blondin, I still think, is one of the, you know, the great overlooked British, and it's a genuine family film that everyone can watch and just doesn't lose anything with time.
There's a great line, my favourite Lionel Jeffries story, which, as far as I'm aware, no one knows, apart from people who were listening to one particular interview that he did many years ago. And I think he was talking about his father, maybe his grandfather, who was in the Skeletal Army, who was set up in opposition to the Salvation Army. And they used to go around sort of demonstrating against, and there used to be fights between the Skeletal Army and the Salvation Army. Isn't that fantastic?
What was the point of the Skeletal Army?
Well, they hated...
to reduce everyone to skeletons?
No, I don't know. They just hated the idea. Skeletal Army were a band, of course. They were a punk band about the same time as the Concert Angels. But originally, Lionel Jeffries' dad or grandfather was in there fighting the Salvation Army.
The point of them being that they didn't believe?
No, and they wanted to drink, presumably. They wanted to drink and they wanted to stand up for immorality.
It seems odd to fight for it, doesn't it? To drink doesn't seem odd at all. But to go out anyway, and campaign for it seems a bit odd.
As you said, there is a moment in this new film which we'll be reviewing later on, The Soloist, in which Robert Downey Jr. is playing a journalist and he goes out to interview somebody who's standing there with a poster which says there's no God. And the only question you can think of is there anything else you don't believe in?
Now, so we have a new film from Julian Fellowes. Now, it's UK premiere at the London Film Festival.
Its UK premiere is at the London Film Festival, and the tickets go on sale tomorrow, Saturday. I've got this website, which I have to read out, which really frightens me. bfi.org.uk/LFF. I've got that right, haven't I?
Yeah.
And the great thing about the London Film Festival is that you can buy tickets. You can buy tickets for the premiere on the 18th. We have an earlier screening on the 15th. You can buy tickets for that. I love that the London Film Festival don't kind of sew up these events.
So it's a premiere, you know, so it's not just showbiz glitterati.
It's not
and
just
Mark.
The red carpet brigade, although I imagine everyone goes over the red carpet. But, you know, you can, as well, tickets last, you can go to that one. I love that.
And it sounds, another thing that intrigues me about your film, Julian, is that it sounds as though it's one of those films where the house, where all this happens, is definitely one of the stars that has to be considered. So tell us about the house where you filmed this, because you had to get that right.
The house is a house in Dorset called Athelhampton. A wonderfully romantic house, which, because of its own history and divided wills and fights and blah, 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 was never modernised. It is essentially as it was in about 1560. And it hasn't had the Victorian drawing rooms and the Georgian thises and thats and the refronting. It is an ancient house. And it has such a personality. It's quite extraordinary. You're quite right. It is a character. It's not a vast house. It's not like sort of Gosford or some sort of huge great nobleman's palace. It's a manor house. But a manor house with an extraordinary, extraordinary character. And I was very lucky because we needed a house which, for reasons you will, I hope, discover later, had to look as if there was once a wing attached to it, but that wing is now gone. And that required a house that was sort of slightly lopsided. And that was exactly what Athelhampton had, because they built one wing and they never built the other.
Apologies to Stephen in Manchester, who's the Skeletal Army, Simon, were a goth band, not a punk band.
Ah,
I remember as a younger man or boy having a thing for their singer Anne-Marie. Anyway. It wasn't that. I mean, I just made a passing reference to that. Clearly, I accept
that. What about New Model Army? Remember New Model Army, who were a sort of, you know, anarcho-punk band, whose lead singer was called Slade the Leveller, but it turned out his real name was Justin.
I don't know. Well, maybe it's a subject for Julian Fellowes' next film.
Yes.
But sadly not.
A very nostalgic thing happened just when we went to the news. Julian said to me, he said, I always remember your hair from The Word. And I'd say, no, that wasn't me. That was Mark Lamar. It's been a long time since I had to do that, because Lamar has had his quiff shaved off for quite some. In fact, he got it shaved off for comic relief.
I think of him as one of the great quiffs, you know, like Elvis and the young Tommy Steele, these sort of extraordinary, almost pieces of modern sculpture, like sort of Barbara.
Are you suggesting that my quiff isn't as good as Mark Lamar's?
No, I'm suggesting it's exactly as good.
Ah, well, good. In that case, you may stay for as long as you like.
I look at it with the eyes of hunger.
Live to Johannesburg, Alison Mitchell, another wicket.
Yep, it's the breakup of that fifth wicket partnership, and Tilan Samrawiera has gone for 30. Paul Collingwood taking back his usual position at backward point, taking a low catch off Stuart Broad. Samrawiera out for 30, 81 for 5 in the 20th over. You get the feeling England getting their grip on the game again.
Alison, thank you very much indeed. Before Julian leaves us, he'll give you that website where you can get those tickets for the UK premiere of his latest film. Let's just get Julian's opinions on a couple of running issues. Pascal on this email. A pox on all multiplexes, he says. They're ruinously ugly, uncomfortable, purveyors of the worst kind of dreck. It's true, I suppose, they occasionally show a film worth watching, but even then they manage to badly mess up the experience. You grumble about having to pay extra for 3D glasses. My grumble is that the hellish multiplexes ruin a good film. Hang on, I'm going to take my headphones off because my headphones got a microphone.
Okay. By playing the soundtrack at antisocially loud volumes!
I'm not deaf, nor do I wish to be. Are they planning on charging extra for ear defenders in the future, or hearing aids for those customers whose hearing has been irrevocably messed up, I'll add. Can we please have a campaign for cinemas to turn the blooming volume down before I turn into a curmudgeon? And I'm not old enough for that yet. Praise then to the Picture House and Screen Chains and all art house cinemas, small, comfortable, sociable, and sadly non-existent in southeast Hertfordshire. Where do you stand on multiplexes, 3D cinemas, and ridiculous volume?
I mean, there are different issues. I don't understand the volume thing. Sometimes you go into a cinema and your ears are just blown off, and I don't know why they do it, unless it comes out of the volume that music is played in the clubs now, and somehow, for the younger viewer, if it isn't loud, it isn't happening. But I'm not sure I agree about multiplexes, actually, because I think you have to remember that in many areas, there is probably only one cinema in quite a wide space. And if you only have one old-fashioned darling old Odeon or something, the chances of getting a slightly minority appeal, a slightly lesser film, are pretty rare. Whereas if you have a multiplex run by an imaginative company, they will have the main, you know, Spider-Man 6 or whatever it is. But in one or two of the screens, they will have something that appeals to a slightly more grown-up audience or a slightly smaller audience. And I think that's the only realistic way you're ever going to see those films in great chunks of the country.
Can I just say the problem with this is twofold. Firstly, that when multiplexes took off, we were told it was going to be more screens for more films. In fact, it's more screens for less films. What happens is the same film ends up playing on more screens because of the way in which distributors now open everything wide. The second thing is, and this is a particular gripe for me, what happens because of the way that multiplexes are run is that you have a projectionist going from projector to projector, turning the cake stand on and then not monitoring the film. And anyone who has sat in a cinema in which the film has gone slightly out of focus or slightly fudgy and knows that the projectionist is nine screens away, starting, you know, the film down there. And funnily enough, I went to see Dorian Gray. I paid to see Dorian Gray the other week. And about 2 second reel in or something, of it being a cake stand, it'll be one reel, it went out of focus. Was anybody watching the picture? No. And that, I think, is the great terrible thing. We have lost the sense that films should be nursed by projectionists. If you go to proper cinemas, there is somebody there the whole time. It's like a performance. It's a theatrical performance. And unless there's somebody there watching the thing being projected, you are not getting your money's worth. End of lecture.
Well, and for me, the out of sync thing is another one that nearly kills me, when the sound is slightly out of sync.
But again, if you had a projectionist watching,
when you
that
have a proper
happen.
Projection. But of course, this is a much larger issue, actually, than just cinema. The whole business of feeling a protective pride in what people are seeing that you've done, that sort of minutiae. I think that's gone in so many areas. But of course, the minute you have this conversation, you sound like you're disgusted of Cheltenham.
But you know, the great story is that Stanley Kubrick...
No one's disgusted in Cheltenham. Everyone's happy.
Everyone's thrilled. Stanley Kubrick, when he'd finished a film, would spend about 6 months going round to cinemas that were showing it, just turning up, watching the film for a bit, and then going up and telling the projectionist, that's the wrong ratio, that's not the right light, the soundtrack isn't right. So whenever you were playing a Stanley Kubrick movie, there was every possibility that the maestro, as long as you were within 30 miles of Hartford, the maestro himself would turn up and explain to you how the film should
that's
be projected.
That's what you should do, Julian.
I kind of agree with that, but I just wish that the projectionist felt that kind of responsibility. But of course, even if he does, if he's running 10
yes,
films,
not,
poor fellow,
it's not their fault.
He's got to somehow make that work. I mean, it's just the system doesn't quite work. But I really do believe that at the moment, although of course I agree with you about the fact it's always the same film, wherever you go to all your local cinemas, always the same main film. But I do believe that to get those slightly more oblique films out to the country, you've got to accept a kind of multiplex.
I think you do, but I think you have to expect more of them. I think that our multiplexes should start properly looking after their screens. I think they should start genuinely attempting to diversify what they show. And they should remember that when the multiplex boom began, we were all promised that if you had six screens, at least one of them would be showing something independent. And, yeah, you know, find me the cinema in which that's always true.
It's not always true, but it is sometimes true.
Sometimes isn't good enough.
But I mean, it is tiresome when Harry Potter is on every one, I agree.
Although I like Harry Potter.
I love Harry Potter. Right, see all those films.
Right, now this is how you can go to see Julian's new movie without paying any... Well, there are tickets available and you might have to pay.
No, you have to pay for them, but the point is you can go to both the main premiere screening or the other one. As long
rub
as there
shoulders
are tickets,
with the rich and famous.
And they start selling them tomorrow morning, Saturday... the 26th. And the address is BFI. Oh, you have to say all the W's,
didn't you,
at the beginning? BFI.org.uk/LFF.
And you ought to know there's a special 1 hour culture show focusing on the LFF.
Is there, Simon? Who's doing that then?
Film festival. Is it you?
It
is both of us.
Is it the both of us?
It's going to be filmed.
That'll be great.
Now, I don't want to confuse you about ticket allocation, because Julian's just made it very, very clear how you can go to his show.
Yes.
But our show is going to be filmed at the BFI South Bank on Sunday the 18th of October, therefore clashing with...
Clashing. With can't go to both, love.
And it's going to go out as part of the Culture Show London Film Festival special on Thursday the 22nd of October. Now, these tickets are free. I'm not saying that they, in any way they're better than Julian's, but they are free, and it's on a first-come, first-served basis.
But you haven't got Maggie Smith.
We haven't got Maggie Smith, but we have got Michael Palin.
Can I tell you about Michael Palin's Freudian slip?
Go on.
I was in Ely, I did a thing with Michael Palin at Ely Cathedral the other day. It was lovely. It was 900 people there doing his, you know, talking about his life in movies. And he said, he used this phrase. He was talking about, you know, well, it's really, really difficult playing against Maggie. I don't mean against Maggie Smith, I mean with Maggie Smith, but it's very interesting that particular slip, because she is formidable and then some.
She is a wonderful actress, though, you know.
I think there is almost none better.
She is extraordinary, and in this film she's so moving. She's so moving, and you know that's extraordinary to me, that these tremendous forces of nature almost, and then they break your heart, you know.
Anyway, I have to complete the parish notices.
Sorry.
Here, okay. So tickets for this Culture Show thing featuring Mark and me and Michael Palin, plus others, probably.
What time is it?
Well,
are you going to come to both?
Maybe you could go as a double feature.
Well, you have to call the BFI box office if you would like to come. And here is the number, 0207 928 3232. A limit of 2 tickets may be reserved per caller, and they must be collected on the day of the event, no later than 9:30 in the morning. And the phone number of the BFI box office, 0207 928 3232.
But when is it? Because we're in the afternoon. We're at 3 in the afternoon. When are you two?
Oh, probably. If it's us, it'll be all day, frankly.
Oh, just sort of going.
Yes.
Well, I would imagine
okay.
So.
It'll probably be.
He's really hard work.
So two other things, just while Julian is with us. Now, you went to Ampleforth, and the reason I mentioned that is I was reading just the other day, apparently they produce the most fantastic cider at Ampleforth, but you can't order it. You have to turn up to Ampleforth to actually buy it.
Well, amongst themselves do. They didn't in my time.
Yes,
I'm sorry
they
did.
No,
say.
Absolutely. And apparently it's 8%. You have to be extremely a bit careful about how much.
How exotic. I always loved the monks on Call the Island producing scent, which I thought in itself had some sort of exotic medieval overtone. But I didn't know my old school
produced
cider.
I thought the old boys should get a case, you know, at Christmas at least. You should
I'll
have
go
a
for
word.
That.
And the last time you came in was for Past Imperfect, your last novel. Is that going to be a movie?
Well, I hope it's going to be a movie. It's been optioned for a movie. And so we're
if
now
only, if only you knew a writer or a director or a producer who could get involved.
Actually, it's a wonderful idea who is producing it. But I, of course, can't reveal it yet. But I am very excited.
Why do you keep turning into Brian Blessed?
It's my other self.
Oh, okay, fine.
I've always admired Brian Blessed, haven't you?
Yes, I think he's marvellous.
But anyway, no, it does look as if it will be a film. Right. But, you know, with British films, there's quite a long sort of Gaza Strip to be crossed before it becomes real.
Julian, always good to have you on the programme. I appreciate you coming in, and all the best for your new film, which sounds fantastic. Thanks very much indeed for coming in. That's Julian Fellowes. We'll talk new movie releases in just a moment. So this text says, as Simon, the manager of the local cinema, says, as the recession gets worse, more people are going to the cinema because nothing helps you forget your financial troubles like a Coke that costs £5.
Very good.
Ziggy, right, Simon. First, New Model Army are socialist, not anarchist. Secondly, they're still going strong. I have a new album out just this week. I
think there's an army coming round and round.
Crass were the anarchists.
Crass were anarcho-syndicalists, as far as I remember.
What's the difference between an anarchist and an anarcho-syndicalist?
I think the anarcho-syndicalists are a bit more organised. The anarchists are smash everything. The anarcho-syndicalists are smash everything, but let's be organised and make a list.
Dan Brown, actually, but he does have to put afterwards.
Not that one.
Dear Jesse and Chester, during an ad break in Terminator 2 on a random digital channel, I was shocked to see not one but 2 Jennifer Aniston film trailers. The first was for the straight-to-DVD release of The Management, a film mentioned a while ago on this very show. The words yogurt mogul came instantly back to mind. And the second was for Love Happens, which seems to be her and Harvey Dent getting it on after the death of his wife. First, I didn't realise that they were different films, as all Jen Aniston films seem to be marketed in exactly the same way. Love, journey, comedy. And hair, I would add, actually, into that. That's some of the common words you hear. I think my issue with her films is not only that Jen is inherently uncinematic, but the films themselves gain nothing from being watched in a cinema. I can't stand these films. I've now started actively campaigning for my friends not to see them. Alan says, this is Alan Sharp, Mark's use of the word parabolic.
Parabolic?
I haven't done much research, but I suspect that it comes from parabola rather than parable. So I'm just saying. Yeah, On the other hand, I treasure his remark about the quality of a film. Length is not a measure of depth, is almost zen. And Hugh, dear JZ and Jay-Z, Simulcra and Simulation by Baudrillard, which is where we were last year, was required reading for the cast of The Matrix and is the hollowed-out book in which Neo keeps his illicit software, right at the very beginning of the film. It regards the distancing of humanity from reality through signs, symbols and simulations, watching TV instead of experiencing things directly. Baudrillard claims that the Wachowski brothers didn't get his work and it was misrepresented in the films. And he also adds, on last week's topic, OxyContin is a prescription painkiller in the US, also known as hillbilly heroin, for which we thank you. So the box office top 10 includes Away We Go at number 10,
which it's a strange response to, because I was saying that I think your response to it depends on where you are in your life and, you know, whether or not you're, you know, middle-aged parent with kids. Obviously, middle-aged parent without kids would be. But I do still think that's right. It's funny how it's divided the critics. I rather liked it. I thought there was something nicely innocent about it. I like the fact that the central couple love each other and carry on loving each other while everything else was. I don't make any claims to it being a masterpiece, and I do understand that it's not for everyone. But I think for a certain armchair section of the population, the people who, if you're the kind of person who, you know, when you sit down make that creaking noise, then I think you'll like Away We Go.
Jack Blackburn says, "Dear large mammal and medium-sized mammal, when I went to see Away We Go, I was a cold, disheartened 20-year-old with no liking of sentimentality and a severely bleak world outlook filled with chaos, disharmony and murder. Despite all of this, Away We Go left me feeling warm and thoroughly entertained.
Good.
Perhaps the youthful, bitter malaise which Mark feared would have denied me such an experience with Mendes's latest was only temporary brought on by my following of another of his recommendations, namely Antichrist. Dear Lord, it is an absolute horrible, repugnant film, misogynist, overlong, pointless and vile. My reaction to it was best summed up by the woman in the couple behind me, who, as Von Trier, put yet more discordant music against a black screen, and we sat there in the dark, wondering if there was anything more to go, simply said, 'I don't think we should indulge him by staying any further.'"
I've seen Antichrist 3 times
well,
now.
There you go.
I think it's Von Trier's best film.
Janie Nottingham, "I'm 8.5... Dear Shyster and Flywheel," which I think we can get away with, "I'm 8.5 weeks pregnant. We're expecting our first child on the 7th of October. Following Mark's review of Away We Go last week, I really fancy going to see it this evening."
Yeah, go on.
"We reckon we need to take every opportunity of going out and seeing grown-up stuff before the baby arrives and we're consigned to several years of children's animations. My question is this. Given my current state of hormonal unpredictability and the imminent event, would Away We Go be a good choice, or would it send us screaming into the night at the thought of what's in store?"
I think it's a good choice because, essentially, as I said, it is, unlike Mendes' previous work, unlike Revolution Road, it is a film about a couple who love each other and carry on loving each other as everyone around them proves to be flaky.
Number 9 is The Firm,
which is, an unnecessary remake of the Alan Clarke original. I mean, the thing is, my problem is, I think Nick Love likes the football hooligans he's depicting more than I do, and I don't think The Firm managed to get under the skin of them in the same way that a film like Away Days did. I do think, however, that he has something. He clearly has style, and I think at some point he's going to produce a really decent film. This isn't it.
Sorority Row is at 8.
It's meat-headed nonsense. And it's updated meat-headed nonsense, but there are a couple of funny lines in it. I don't think there's enough funny lines in it to justify going to the cinema. But if it came, if it was late of a night with a six pack and you were watching it on DVD, you'd be surprised at how funny some bits of it are. But you wouldn't be surprised at how reprehensible other bits of it are.
Julian Junior's at 7.
Again, apparently Muriel is doing a perfect impression of the woman that she's playing. The fact that I hadn't heard of her, Julia Child, is apparently my fault. I'm willing to accept that. The fact that the film isn't as entertaining as it ought to be and doesn't hang together is Nora Ephron's fault.
Dorian Gray is this week's number 6.
Despite the fact that I watched some of it out of focus, my main problem was still...
Hence your anger.
No, I was trying to sort of to say that wasn't what I was angry about, although I was angry about the focus thing. There are things in it that are interesting. Colin Firth is very good. It doesn't have, I think, the depth of previous productions, and I think all of the faults with it are perfectly summed up in the idea of doing the painting as a sort of CGI squibbly thing, as opposed to just doing a really good, scary painting.
Final Destination, 5.
Not being, not going, don't care.
500 Days of Summer at 4.
Ooh, zooey-dooey.
Now, it's Gamer at number 3. Mark Paling, BSc Honours, Multimedia Technology and Production, Gold Band Swimming Award, Class of 93.
Very good.
"Dear Joel and Ethan, with a sense of dread and trepidation, I went to see Gamer this week, starring the one-man charisma vacuum that is Gerard Butler.
Gerard!
butler!
Crass, sickening, overly violent, too loud, no characters, no plot. It truly is an assault on all the senses that seemed to vastly outstay its welcome, despite the fact that it ran for something like 80 minutes.
Yeah.
I was surprised the Good Doctor didn't stress the misogynistic streak.
I did!
I know you did. That runs through this tasteless train wreck of a film. This film only furthers the myth that computer games are aimed solely at immature teenage boys only interested in guns, explosions and ogling women. It is true. It truly is the type of film that makes you want to take a shower afterwards. It is vile.
I think you'll find that I did stress the fact that there is something incredibly leery about their whole aesthetic, and it's apotheosis in Crank 2? Do I mean apotheosis? I always get that wrong. Zenith, nadir, zenith, apotheosis.
Apothecary, chemist.
Finds it's chemist.
Timothy White.
That's right.
Dear Jack and Vera, how boring is it to watch someone else play a video game? The answer is very, and Gamer is more dull than that. It's like a badly executed version of Death Race, right down to there being government corporate shenanigans behind the violent game, which in both films is a huge media phenomenon.
It is.
Both films even have a hero who's been wrongly imprisoned and pines for his wife and daughter in stereotypical fashion.
Yep, has flashbacks.
For people who want to see this bad taste film, I would advise them staying in and renting out Running Man. Simon in Exeter. Dear Chris Evans and Pointless, brackets, the Good Doctor was picked out as a possible answer on Tuesday's show of the BBC Two quiz, Pointless. It turned out to be the wrong answer, as he wasn't a presenter on Radio 2. I saw Gamer at the weekend.
That's really mean, isn't it?
As I am an unapologetic Crank fan, and was interested how Neville Dean and Taylor, the directors, would get on without the staff, otherwise known as
Jason Statham.
Thank you. And I have to admit, despite all the guns and explosions going on, I was catatonically bored. It had a good last 25-30 minutes, but the preceedingly dull hour beforehand ruined any chance that Gamer had of being entertaining.
The preceedingly dull? It's either preceding dull or the exceedingly dull. He didn't make preceedingly good cakes.
No, it's the preceedingly dull hour beforehand. So it's the hour beforehand that was preceedingly dull. Anyway, don't quibble. It's horrible. District 9 is at number 2.
Which I still like very much. There's been an awful lot of stuff on our Twitter.
Well, now, this came about because a friend of mine who knows South Africa very well said he enjoyed the film, but he thought that there isn't a problem with the fact that the Nigerians are behind most of the crime in the film, because a lot of people in South Africa know that to be the case. It was the bit where they wanted to eat the flesh of our main man.
Yes.
And it's that bit, which is the cannibal bit, which he thought, no, that makes it racist. So I put it on Twitter just to see what people thought. Overwhelmingly, they disagreed, but it was the cannibalism bit that they thought maybe have tipped it over the edge.
Yeah, no, I understand. I mean, I think what's interesting is just how sort of enthusiastically the argument has been fought on both sides. I mean, I don't think the film is racist, and I think the film is, to me, has quite clearly a very liberal sensibility, but it is interesting how it is possible for very small but significant, some people, events can completely tip something. And it was very interesting that, as you said, that was the thing that for him meant that it was a problem. I didn't find it a problem. I thought that was much more to be seen broadly within the kind of, because it does have a cartoony structure and it does have, you know, broad satire, and its stereotyping is not singular. But I don't think it's a racist film.
Martin in London went to see District 9 this week. I really enjoyed it. However, the following day I spoke to my brother, who it turned out had seen it last week. I told him I liked it. He said, that was probably the worst film I've ever seen. Man hates aliens. Man likes aliens. Man turns into an alien. Ho-hum. Give me Transformers any day.
No. Go and see Enemy Mine, which, of course, itself is a remake of Hell in the Pacific, isn't it? But Enemy Mine is related to District 9 as well.
UK's number one, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
And I liked it. I liked Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs very much. I don't think the 3D thing needs to be written or talked about any longer. We all know it's not necessary. But I think it's a funny film because it has a genuine, surreal sensibility. The script is funny. It's not just a bunch of celebrity voiceovers. It's people who are actually doing the voiceovers because they're funny. It's got some very, very disturbing visuals, which I like. I've said that there's something very Lynchian about it. It's like Eraserhead for kids.
Sam Inglis in Tunbridge. I don't always, or even often, agree with Dr. Kermode, but I did want to say thanks for his recommendation of Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Without his and other glowing reviews, I would never have sat down to see what is one of my favourite films of the year so far.
Good.
From first frame to last, I was laughing practically non-stop, grateful to see a comedy that doesn't mistake being edgy for being funny or being rude for being irreverent. By the way, I saw it in 2D, the first time I've done so with a film released in a 3D version, and not only did I love the visuals, I couldn't see one shot that made me think the film would benefit from being in 3D. And Mark in Cheltenham, PhD, MBA, MSc, BSc honours. Good heavens. Hi, Larry and Flint. Went to see Cloudy with the Chance of Meatballs. Excellent. Something for everybody and even Mr. T in the voice cast. Look out for the throwaway a la mode gag. Funniest cross-cultural joke at the expense of the Brits you'll see all year. Anything we can squeeze in before half past?
Very quickly. I'll do this very quickly. There's a film called The Crimson Wing, which is a documentary about flamingos. And it's the life cycle of flamingos, and it's, you know, oh, aren't flamingos, haven't they got an extraordinary life cycle? And the main...
There must be more to it than that.
Well, no, they have got an extraordinary life cycle. Well, you know, the birds come to a very remote place. It's a big lake. The lake dries up. There's a salt island. They lay the eggs on the salt island. The chicks are born. The chicks get weighed down by salt. Some of them live... So, two things to say. Firstly... obviously, to read to you from the BBFC, it's rated PG, and as is always the case with this, it says, for example, that there are disturbing sequences. Abandoned chicks are shown caked in salt deposits before passing on, and a brief animal mating sequence. Like, it's like a, you know, it's a wildlife documentary. The thing that's important is they're not penguins. And all the time I'm sitting there watching The Crimson, the version that I saw that was narrated by Mariella Frostrop, incidentally. You remember when March of the Penguins came out, and it was, I think we got the Morgan Freeman version, although on different territories it was narrated by very different people, and Morgan Freeman basically did do the voice of God.
Yes.
As, you know, the penguins did this extraordinary thing. And then there was a marvellous thing that all these people came out and said, oh, marvellous, marvellous, this, you know, demonstration of, you know, obviously, you know, God working in the universe, all these penguins looking after each other, you know, male penguin, female penguin, baby penguin. Then it turned out that there's a surprising number of gay penguins. This was a big fuss. Well, the thing is, there's none of that with the flamingos. And all I'm really impressed by the flamingos, and the flamingo photography is extraordinary, and there's an awful lot of stuff of the baby flamingos not making it, which I suppose is honest. But two problems. Firstly, they're not penguins, and I did feel that they were the sort of second run team. I did feel that there must have been a meeting which somebody went, you know, that film with the penguins, that was great, what you got now? Meerkat? No, done them. Tuna? Done them. I know, flamingos, because they're weird and pink. And the second thing is, there is something very jarring about the fact that if you're going to have a documentary which has got a voiceover which really anthropomorphizes what's going on, really uses human emotions, you know, love and all that sort of thing, it sits rather oddly then with the scenes of lots and lots of little babies not having a happy ending. I think, in a way...
Do you mean they're dying?
Yes,
lots and lots of babies not having a happy ending... It says what, they don't get ice cream or something. I mean,
yeah, but although the film tries to make it that they do, because they go back into the water and become the salt that then becomes the island that the thing is growing.
They die.
Yes, but all I'm saying is you can have it one of two. You can either have a nature documentary that says nature red in tooth and claw, fine, or you can have a documentary that goes, ooh, ha, ooh, ah, ooh, angels, lake of fire, la, 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 la. But you can't have a documentary that goes, angels, lake of fire, chicks dying, more dying, more dying. You can't do both.
Fine.
One or the other. That, incidentally, wasn't an impression of Mariella Frostrop, clearly, who, incidentally, I think is a very good narrator.
Just need to clear this up. Mark Restall, brackets, Peace Studies, BA Honours. Dear Scratch and Sniff. Right, number one. Crass were anarchist in name only, more radical liberal than anything, which I find because I think of Shirley Williams as a radical liberal. Not, yeah. Hang on. They definitely weren't anarcho-syndicalists, being concerned largely with individual liberty. Two, anarcho-syndicalism is a form of anarcho-communism that sees workplace organising as the key organising form and shares the general anarcho-communist aim of a bottom-up, democratically controlled socialist society. So just get it right.
Yeah, the People's Popular Front of Judea.
Fairholme, BSc and MA. Dear Mahoney and Hightower, is it just me, or did Simon last week say hello to Martin Sheen rather than Michael Sheen?
You did.
From Tony Blair to President Bartlett in one fell swoop. It's true, actually, I did.
You did. So
apologies. Yep. So let's make sure that we say hello to Michael Sheen.
And to Jason Isaacs.
And to Stephen Fry.
And to all the members of Fairport Convention.
And focus and dump his rusty nuts.
Are we doing dump his rusty nuts?
No. I just put that in. And David
Morrissey.
And Crass.
Let's say hello to Crass.
Do you think they're still going?
Well,
let's not say they're anarcho-syndicalists.
Old anarchists never die.
They're not radical liberals.
Because really,
there must be lots of radical liberals who are more radical. And I don't know. I never saw, you know, because they had that big A sign with a circle around it, and that A doesn't stand for radical liberal, I don't think. Tim in Nottingham, I caught Basic Instinct 2 on TV the other day.
I love that film.
And while I enjoyed it, I couldn't help feeling there was something parodic about it.
There is.
And if you ever see David Morrissey again, could you ask him, was Sharon Stone a good kisser? Well, we'll do that. So hello to David, wherever he may be.
I saw it, funny enough, I turned on the television and it was on. I have to say, I watched about half an hour of it because it is so funny. I mean, it is literally like a bunch of people sat down and went, okay, let's see how far we can get with this. That thing about she left early, how Lacanian of her. Fantastic.
Give us something brand new.
Creation, which, as its title suggests, is about creation. Or is it? So, Paul Bettany came on the programme a while ago and said that he was
the
making... The
fantastic Paul Bettany,
who I love, think is very good. And Paul Bettany plays Charles Darwin, and the film is directed by John Emil, and it is essentially a story of the writing of On the Origin of Species. And it's about how the theories came to be put down. This is some sort of turning to Monty Python. This is my theory, and it is mine, and this is my theory that I have. How the theories came to be put down in writing as told as a human drama. Okay? So, in the human drama, essentially what happens is that Charles Darwin, the later period Charles Darwin, is remembering himself as the younger period Charles Darwin, Paul Bettany doing both of them, I have to say, equally well. I mean, I think Paul Bettany is a really terrific actor, and see him in Creation, it's actually worth seeing the film.
If he listened, we should be saying hello to him.
But hello to Paul Bettany.
Well, maybe he has to prove that he listens.
Okay, fine. So, Paul, if you text in, we will carry on saying hello to you. If you don't, shame on you. Why aren't you listening in? Okay, fine. So, I've got a little clip. The film also features Toby Jones, who, as you know, I'm a very big fan of. This, a clip from early on in the movie, in which Darwin, who has, he's done his research, but doesn't want to commit it to paper because he is aware that what he is doing may be seen as blasphemous and heretical. Here's a clip.
We're reforming the Linnaean Society. The committee will comprise of myself, Lyle, Hooker, yourself, of course, if you're game for it. Now that Hooker and I finally have a bit of clout, we can start to reclaim science as a profession, wrested away from the country parsons and beetle collectors.
Some of whom are dear friends of mine.
Your book will be our rallying point.
No, it won't. There is no book. There's fragments, and they're not in any fit state.
Nonsense. I've read your detailed abstract, and the argument is hugely powerful. Clear evidence of transformation over millions of years from a free-swimming prawn to a shellfish stuck on a rock.
Well, that's my point. You see, you can't be entirely sure of that, and that's why I need more time. I need...
Mr. Darwin, sir.
Yes.
Either you are being disingenuous, or you do not fully understand your own theory. Evidently, what is true of the barnacle is true of all creatures, even humans. Clearly, the Almighty can no longer claim to have authored every species in under a week. You've killed God, sir.
Are you sure Rufus Sewell isn't in there somewhere?
Well, but almost certainly. Certainly.
Paul Bettany was sounding a bit like Rufus there.
But Paul Bettany always sounds to me like, you know, a different character. I mean, I think actually that's one of the things I like most about Paul Bettany is that he doesn't just do the same part over and over again. So, a number of things to say. The first is, I have to say I went into this with great trepidation because I thought that it was possible that it was going to be a bit of a plod. It was going to be earnest, it was going to be well-mounted, it was going to be all those things, but it was going to be a bit of a plod. And I have to say that it wasn't. At the centre of it, of course, is essentially a debate about faith. Because what happens in the movie, as opposed to what necessarily happened in real life, is that you have a central conflict between Darwin and his wife, played by Jennifer Connelly, who is, of course, in real life, Paul Bettany's wife. And she has strong religious beliefs. He has failing or failed religious beliefs, partly due, as far as we can tell from the film, to the loss of his daughter. And he is confronted with the fact that if he puts down on paper his theories about origin of species, that in fact what he will be doing will be seen as anti-religious, and that will set him at odds with his wife. It will also, to some extent, compromise his own relationship to the loss of his daughter. So it is essentially about the act of faith, but whether that faith is in the faith of science or faith in the Almighty or faith in God, because he is visited throughout the film by the ghostly apparition of his daughter. Not ghostly as in we think she's a ghost, but ghostly as in he sees her because his mind is fevered and he is not well. And so he is constantly visited by, you know, somebody from the dead. So it's interesting that there's been a lot written about the film, but it's a film about evolution, and it's therefore it's a problem in America, because in America there's a great sort of, you know, wave of people who believe that actually, you know, everything began on day one. And funnily enough, there's a piece in one of the only magazines I know about,
The Guardian.
Time Out. Well done.
Sight and Sound.
Time Out. which Steve Jones, who's professor of genetics at UCL, University College London, says the true date of life's origin is, in fact, 500 times further into the past than the creationists believe, and its true mechanism is own emergence and not divine intervention. He then goes on to write in this article saying it's very good because what the film does do is it does say this is how things worked out. It does attempt to botch it at the end by saying that the last sentence of Origin of Species, there is a mention of the creator. And he says, well, actually, Darwin only put that in later on. And he says, this is the sentence that I really sort of had a little bit of a problem with. He talks about the fact that there is no place in the... It says, yes, here we are. His or her, meaning God's, presence is irrelevant to the scientific argument and disguises the real truth that Darwin, who initially had a vague plan to become a clergyman, began to lose his faith quite early. It seems to me that whichever side of this particular debate you're on, and, you know, I mean, I'm pro-evolution. That's it. You know, I believe all that. Fine, great. I do find sometimes that there is a sort of hectoringness in the scientific communities where you go, this is, then that's not, OK? One of the things that the film does is it doesn't at any point deny that a good part of the story is about faith of some description, because what's happening is that the central character believes in his marriage, but his marriage appears to be falling apart as a result of what he believes in scientifically. He believes in his daughter, but he's also losing faith in his own relationship to his daughter, because there is the possibility that his faith in a bogus water therapy was somehow responsible for her not getting over the illness that she had. He has faith in the idea of great scientific inquiry, but he doesn't necessarily believe that putting his scientific inquiry into the public domain is the best thing to do for the world and for him and for his wife. So what interested me was, essentially, everything else aside, and there are many good things to say about the film, not least the performances and the fact that I think the script is well written. Obviously, it does a certain degree of dramatisation. I'm sure that people who know this subject far better than I do can say, that didn't happen, he didn't write that, that was in the wrong place. Fine, don't mind. Dramatically, however, as a film about somebody struggling with their beliefs, whatever those beliefs are, I thought it did a really pretty convincing job. And I thought the thing that was interesting about it is, despite what's being said about it by some people, I think you could take the film and accept it regardless of what your beliefs are. I mean, I oddly think that no matter how fearsome one's religious convictions may be, and there may be people who simply, you know, absolutely believe in creationism, which I don't, I still think they could watch Creation and find in it material that made sense to them. I think the strength of the film is that it is, in the end, a film about faith, whatever that faith may be. And I think that made it an interesting film.
It was great fun when you got into trouble with the intelligent design stuff. That penguin film.
I know.
That was a fantastic... That was quite a highlight, actually.
It was, wasn't it?
Because...
One of the things that's really annoying about this is that people, they want to be absolute about things. Here's my rule.
That's because they're scientists and all the evidence says...
Fine. So, you believe in evolution. I believe in evolution. You believe in evolution. We all believe in evolution.
Well, hang on. Don't just point at Louise and say, you believe in evolution and not give her a chance.
Excuse me. Hold on.
She might not.
Wait. Louise, do you believe in evolution?
Yes.
Thank you. We all believe in evolution. Okay?
Well, not everybody does.
No. In this room... We all believe in evolution. Fine. Does that mean that therefore all science is wrong and all science is right and all religion wrong? No. You know what I believe in fundamentally? I believe that you should never believe anybody who believes themselves to be completely right, and that includes me.
Dear Doc Holliday and Doc Martin went to see Creation this afternoon. This is Chris who sends this in. I was bitterly disappointed. On the plus side, see, he even writes his review like you taught.
Yeah, exactly.
John Emile directs superbly, and it's good to see him return to his British roots after years of Hollywood rubbish. Paul Bettany also delivers the goods, but both talents are badly served by a script that too often turns into daft melodrama. The device of the daughter haunting her father is irrational and mad. Darwin didn't believe in ghosts or the afterlife and denounced it several times. To have this device merely shows how little respect and understanding of Darwin the film has.
Okay, fine. Again, your man Steve Jones picks this up, says, you know, Darwin did... A, it's a dramatic device. B, it's meant to demonstrate a fevered, you know, imagination. C, melodrama. There's nothing wrong with melodrama. Okay, if you want documentary, there is nothing fundamentally wrong with melodrama. And I think as a melodramatic device, it worked.
What's next?
Travel, I
no,
believe.
No, after Travel.
Oh, well,
it's a way of teasing people into the next movie.
Surrogates.
After Travel.
Bruce Willis is a robot.
In a vest?
Well,
almost certainly.
In certain states of undress, yeah, you shall
tried,
we say.
You tried to chat my wife up once. Do you know that?
No, when was that? Yes,
at London Zoo a couple of years back.
Cad. Really?
Never forgiven him for that.
Was anyway, he in a vest?
I think he was in a vest, but he had clothing, other clothing on top.
Okay. Did he sidle up to your wife and point to some penguins and say, do you think they're a demonstration of divine intervention?
That's exactly what he said.
It was. Okay.
How extraordinary. Andy and Evesham, dear Big A and Little A, Crass are no longer going strong as a band. Though Steve Ignorant, the co-founder, did perform Crass's entire Feeding of the 5000 album at the Shepherd's Bush Empire in 2007, backed by a band of selected guests. Other members of Crass were not involved in these concerts. There you go, lots of Crass information.
But is that like a tribute band, Steve Ignorant's Crass? You know, like Les Gray's Mud.
And Joe in Kyoto, one of your favourite places.
Yeah, I love Kyoto.
Did I just hear the Doctor complaining about the scientific community hectoring? Yeah. I love the Doctor and do tend to agree with him on most films that I see his reviewed. But if there is one person who shouldn't hectors, lecture about hectoring, it is the good Doctor.
That is why I did finish that thing by saying, you shouldn't believe anybody who thinks they're right, including me.
What a silly old Hector.
You are
indeed. So we have Bruce in a vest.
Very quickly. There's not a whole load to say about Surrogates. They held back the National Press show until Wednesday, which was really annoying, which is why I had to go and see it this morning. This is the way everything's going. Don't show you. I mean, whenever you don't get shown a film in advance, it's generally a sign that they don't have much confidence in it. In the case of Surrogates, it's a Bruce Willis science fiction movie that is very much like many other science fiction films that you will have seen. The plot is essentially the near future. At least it's near enough that everyone is still driving exactly the same cars that they're driving now, but it's far enough away that they've managed to create a whole race of walking sims. You know, we had this discussion about what Sims are, okay? So, everyone can have a Sim.
We didn't have a discussion about what Sims are. You sort of weren't quite sure, and I told you, and then that was it.
Isn't that how discussion works? I ask you a question and you tell me the answer and I agree with it.
Oh, yes.
Fine. So we had a discussion about it. And so he's in the near future. People are now getting sort of lethargic. They sit around on their sofas wired up to Sims. The Sims go out and live their lives for them. The life that he's leading is an investigator. Suddenly, somebody starts killing Sims. And when the Sims die, the operators of the Sims are also dying as well. So there is a new threat to Sims and to their operators. And it looks like it might be an inside job. Here's a clip.
You want to kill everyone? And that's going to heal mankind?
They're already dead. They died the minute they plugged into those machines.
This is not the solution.
That's the way it is.
That's not the way it is.
I had a vision. I was going to empower the powerless, to enable others like me to walk, to feel, to live a normal life.
Listen to me. They're going to call you a murderer. That's what you're doing.
Surrogacy is a perversion. It's an addiction. And you have to kill the addict to kill the addiction.
Upload complete.
You're too late. What I've done can't be stopped. Now you're going to be a witness to the rebirth of humanity.
No, it's
there we go. We're on.
It was that Tom Wiggins. No, it's your man from Babe, James Thingy. What's his name? Hang on, you know who I mean.
I thought that was Tom Wilkinson there.
No. What's his name?
I don't know. You've seen the film.
It'll come to me in a moment. You know the guy from That'll Do, Babe. That'll Do. Him. I'm sorry, I'm having a totally senior moment.
I'm really glad I asked you that question. I just thought it sounded like Tom Wilkinson.
Let me look at the entire...
No, process. Just give us the review.
Yeah, fine. Anyway, well, so the story... I mean, basically, it is so much like so many other things that you've seen. The idea of people not living their life, but it's all happening out there, to some extent, you could trace that back to Pete Townsend's Lifehouse, which ended up being Who's Next? And it's The Matrix, in which we have the Baudrillard book as being such a big thing. It's essentially a little bit like The Island, which, of course, is an unofficial remake of Clonus and the Clonus horror. It's not entirely unlike Gamer, in which people are controlled by other people, the people being Gerard Butler and other masculine types like that. It's a little bit like AI because there's, you know, mechanical people and there's a whole thing about mechanical children. And so all those ideas you've seen before, plus Bruce Willis, shaven-headed, in a science fiction film, looking a bit bedraggled, reminds you of 12 Monkeys. And whilst I'm thinking of all these other films, I'm thinking...
James Cromwell?
Thank you very much. Okay. But that's probably a voice in your headphones
it was.
Said it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you see, I don't have that voice in my
head. You can
head.
If you wish.
No, I don't want it.
I can just
I'd rather
switch.
Look foolish in front of the nation, not remembering what the guy's name, but just remembering, that'll do, babe, that'll do, whilst you get somebody in your headphones says, James Cromwell, thank you for pointing that out. So the problem with it is it's short. It's 88 minutes long. I have to say it felt a lot longer. I thought it was about 2 hours long. Then I came out and it was a lot earlier than I thought. Bruce Willis looks like he's kind of phoning in his performance. It's fine, but it's nothing like the depth or complexity of his best science fiction work, which is clearly 12 Monkeys. It's directed with a certain amount of panache, but also a certain amount of just straightforward, put tab A into slot B. It runs along for a little bit, and then it stops, and then it ends, and you think, fine, very, very inconsequential 12A multiplex fare that will be in for 1 week, and then will go, and will not leave much of an impression. I mean, it wasn't terrible by any means, and I think that it should have been shown to the press earlier, because it wouldn't have got, you know, a total slating, but it's spectacularly unremarkable.
Peter in Leicester, Betsy and Bruce, fairly quiet Friday off, decided to take in a film early today, went to For Surrogates. What a disappointing and predictable rerun of iRobot, even more
yes,
so
I
because
Robert, yeah.
of the use of the same creator, in inverted that word again, actor in both. If I had the time, I would have walked straight into District 9 to try and get over the border. My advice, steer clear of Surrogates. If you really want to know what it's like, pay someone else to go for you.
That's a very good gag. That's a very good gag.
But that's what you're for.
I believe, Simon, that I listen to the listeners.
Dear Williams and Centimoo.
I need to do the soloist as well, but
go ahead.
No, go on.
The Reverend Clive Deverell says, at the cinema in Peterborough, I was on my own. No one else.
The Surrogates?
Watching The Soloist.
Oh, The Soloist.
A good film.
Very good.
Not overcooked, in my opinion, with a powerful message of friendship, overcoming the mental illness, great performances of Jamie Foxx, Robert Downey Jr. This is what The Good Doctor thinks.
So, the story, which is inspired by real events, based on a true story. Made up, essentially. Is the story of a journalist, Steve Lopez, played by Robert Downey Jr. Robert Downey Jr.
Is that a new voice you've been
No. We've done Robert Downey Jr. before. He was in Iron Man, wasn't he? And Jeff Bridges! There, remember, that's how Iron Man went. And then Jamie Foxx and Nathaniel Ayers. What happens is that Steve Lopez is walking around, feeling that his life isn't really going anywhere and his career's not going anywhere and he's divorced. Although in real life, he isn't actually divorced, apparently. And he finds a derelict, homeless guy who turns out to be actually a musical prodigy who was at Juilliard, then dropped out and somehow ended up on the streets. And he makes it his mission to write about this character and to somehow put him back on the road to recovery. And doing so, he has some success, but not a huge amount of success. He tries to get him back into society, back into housing. He doesn't want to do that. He wants to be independent. There are some scenes in it which are clearly devised entirely for the drama. They are melodramatic, but they were problematic for me in a way that Creation wasn't, because they sort of stood out. There are other elements of it which are more realistic. The fact that we don't have a miracle cure, the fact that the guy's problems are not solved overnight, the fact that there is some sense of open-endedness about the story. A couple of problems with it are this. Firstly, we're into awards season, and the arrival of The Soloist is kind of like, here we go, now it's the worthy films about people doing good things based on real-life stories, and I'm sure that we're going to see this for your consideration. Robert Downey Jr. is doing essentially the Robert Downey Jr. performance, which is perfectly fine, although nothing overly remarkable. No, Jamie Foxx is playing the guy who's musically talented, and Jamie Foxx is, of course, musically talented. He is a musician, and he clearly worked very hard to study the mannerisms of this guy who has behavioral problems and has mental problems and has, you know, almost like too much creative electricity to deal with. And yet, I have to say, his performance ended up being very performance-like. You do feel like you are watching somebody doing an awards-worthy performance. And I have to say that the minute I see that, the kind of the barriers come down. I find it very, very hard to warm to films in which I feel like there is some kind of underlying worthiness. Give me trash. Give me trash every day. Give me good, honest trash rather than stuff which calls out for me to appreciate it on a worthy level. The film is directed by Joe Wright, who I am still very, very agnostic about. I don't think that Joe Wright has yet demonstrated the great talent that everybody says he is. I mean, he's, you know, Atonement, things like that. I don't yet have evidence in front of me that he's a brilliant storyteller. So what you have is a strange mixture of individual bits of it, the movie, that are quite interesting, individual bits of it that tell you that there's a story that you know that in fact the real story would be kind of more interesting because more strange and twisted and not so neatly sewn up and not so melodramatic. There's a couple of moments in it that were really cronky. There's a moment in it when Tom Hollander plays a character who comes in and he looks like he's going to be helpful. He's a cello teacher and he looks like he's got all the best intentions to help this guy, you know, sort of re-find his feet. And then a thing happens is that he turns his cello case and you see he's got a fish sign on the side of it. You know, fish sign, you know, the Christian sign, right?
Yeah.
You've seen the ones which are fish with feet, which people got Darwin written on. He's very funny, right? But he's got a fish sign. The minute you see there's a fish sign, you know he's going to turn out to be a bad one. And of course, what happens is his character turns out to push Nathaniel Lees in completely the wrong way and for all the wrong reasons. And it's a very, very weird, sort of cronky and I think rather badly handled stereotype character that stands out as, you know, really awkward within the drama. I think that there are moments in it when it achieves an intimacy between the two central characters, but far too much of it felt like the TV movie of the week. And it's not Shine. And there are things that are wrong with Shine, but watching this, those things seem very small.
If you want to come and see the special culture show edition at the London Film Festival, presented by your favourite film doctors, it's at the BFI South Bank, Sunday the 18th of October. It's going to go out on the 22nd. The BFI box office is who you have to call, 0207 928 3232. Two tickets may be reserved per caller. You have to pick them up on the day of event no later by 9:30, and your movie of the week would be what?
Well, I would say Creation.
Why do you say it with a question mark at the end?
As okay, well, I would, because I don't like people to be, you know...
With an exclamation mark?
No, I'd say, well, I would say Creation, but hey, what do I know? Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, head to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode and check out my blog, Kermode Uncut.